moving single file on triple red alert, the companions followed the vague remnants of a road down the flanks of the broad, low mountain. Ryan had no doubt that the road, overgrown as it was with grass shoots as sharp as steel needles, pierced and cracked by stunted thorny trees tough enough to survive the acid fall, had been unrecognizable before the Stickies had taken that route. After they had passed, as JB had predicted, it was like walking on the tracks of a whirlwind. In the moonlight, curving down the slope ahead, Ryan could see the swath of freshly trampled earth and crushed foliage. He and the others took care to give the broken branches a wide berth. A gummy sap dripped from the wounds in the tree limbs and pooled in white puddles on the ground. The corrosive sap could strip the flesh from bone in a matter of seconds. Once it entered the bloodstream, the milky juice burned like wildfire, destroying everything it touched. A sulfurous dawn started to leak through blue-black cloud banks on the horizon as the travelers neared the valley floor. They encountered no Stickies en route and saw no sign of human refugees either. Ryan halted the column behind an outcrop, and while his companions rested, he cautiously surveyed the terrain below. The middle of the valley was split by a great pre-dark highway. Though his distant view was obscured to the right by air rank with low-hanging smoke, the road appeared to run the entire length of the basin. It was 6 lanes wide and had a crumbling median strip that had once separated a two-way flow of traffic. No one was moving on the highway now, and beyond it, on Ryan's left, their immediate goal was no longer visible. The raging fires that had acted like a beacon during the long night's trek had burned down, leaving behind a dense pall of smoke that concealed whatever remained of the ville.
"Can't see a damn thing from here anymore. Let's get closer."
The others pulled themselves together. They all trotted down to the road, and once there, turned into the cloud of swirling smoke. Visibility dropped to 15 or 20 feet. They had to slow their pace and close ranks. A sudden breeze shifted the haze. Looming up in front of them was a massive barrier of concrete rubble, a highway overpass that hadn't survived the new quakes. It had collapsed a century before, blocking all 6 lanes. Ryan led them to the left, off the road, following a two-rut track that diverted traffic around the barrier. As they rounded the end of the fallen overpass, they came upon a series of neat piles of concrete chunks that had been reduced to pebbles. Some pathetic soul had been chipping it away, trying to salvage the rusty steel reinforcement that interlaced the concrete. When they returned to the pavement, they caught a glimpse of the dead ville. What they saw on the other side of the median strip to the right of the highway was a red-orange glow pulsing in the depths of the swirling smoke. Ryan took them over the median, then across the 3 paved lanes. Before they reached the other side, they could feel the heat from the banks of live embers. Another 2-rut lane led from the side of the highway to the center of the glowing mass.
"Slow and careful."
The one-eyed warrior pointed out the deep 2-foot-wide holes in the ground where the Bill's stockade wall had once stood. Leg breakers for sure. The Stickies had pulled out all the defensive perimeter's sharpened logs and fed them to the blaze. Inside the broad circle of holes, the monsters had burned everything to the ground. The roofs and walls of the huts had been torn apart, and what couldn't be moved to the central pyre had been burned where it stood. Ash piles marked the foundations of the clustered, crude dwellings. Smoke still rose from scattered hotspots among the ashes, and fingers of fire licked up from a great pile of coals in the middle of the ring. Mildred walked quickly ahead of the others, moving toward the center of the inferno in a straight line, kicking up puffs of ash from the heaps that drifted around her ankles. She seemed distracted and disoriented, oblivious to the blast furnace heat. Christy started after her. As Ryan moved to follow, he stepped on something underfoot. He knelt and brushed the blanket of warm ash away. He saw the fire-blackened teeth of a child, scattered like tiny seeds in the dirt. Pushing more of the ash aside, he found a little jawbone, part of the cheek crushed by stamping feet. He could see the prints of bare soles in the soft ground. There were other bones pounded into the soil as well, the bones of livestock and adult humans. All of them had the flesh burned off, all of them broken into small pieces. Ryan hadn't seen such systematic and total destruction in a long time. Apparently, these Stickies were no longer content with the hit-and-run slaughter that until now had been their trademark. They had, with considerable expenditure of time and energy, erased not only these poor humans, but all traces of their presence. When the next round of chemstorm swept past, the broken bones would dissolve in the downpour of dilute hydrochloric acid. The cinder piles would sizzle and froth and melt away. Nothing would be left but the ring of holes. As Ryan stood, his head was flooded with a vision of the horror that had been done here only hours before. The screams, the pain, the blood. In the pit of his stomach, something dark and malevolent stirred.
Wickedness and misery, my dear Ryan.
The old man had knelt too, and was sieving warm ash and bone chips through his fingers. He wiped the white powder on the lapels of his frock coat.
Wickedness and misery. What we have spread before us is a deed of uncommon evil.
You're right, Doc. This one's triple mean.
Ryan looked up to see Christy returning from the center of the ville with Mildred. She held a sheltering arm around the doctor's shoulders. When the two women got closer, he realized that Mildred's clothes had caught on fire. The legs of her camouflage fatigue pants were charred at the cuffs and knees, and still spilling puffs of smoke. Her face bathed in sweat, Mildred seemed to be coming out of some kind of a shuddering fit. Her arms and legs twitched so violently that she could barely walk without Christy's help.
What happened?
She got too close to the coals. I think something's wrong with her, Ryan. If I hadn't stopped her, she would have walked right into the fire. This place is doing something to her mind. We've got to get away from here.
Ryan nodded. It was doing something to his mind, too. Jack was waiting for them on the far side of the Ring of Devastation. He seemed unusually agitated and impatient to move on.
Jack, how many do you figure we're tracking?
Thousands.
Jack brushed strands of the lank shoulder-length white hair from his face, his red eyes grim.
Thousands?
Yeah.
Dark night. Hundreds, the biggest colony I've ever come across. And that was deep in the heavily nuked zone.
This isn't a colony, JB. This is a goddamn army.
There was no denying the truth of his words. In the depopulated, largely disarmed, post-New-Cost world, it didn't take many troops to make a formidable force. Wars had been fought, and won, with a few dozen mercies or sekmen carrying guns. With much less, an enterprising baron could take slaves and extort tribute from a wide area.
Fielding an army takes organization and planning. Something Stickies haven't shown us before. Every other time we've run into a large group of them outside the nuke zones, they've always been working under a cold-heart human or a non-Sticky mutant. Someone intelligent enough to plan battle strategy.
Some say Stick is a gnomes. Genes just rad-melted.
Another popular hypothesis is that their perverse physiology is the result of prolonged exposure to nitrate-contaminated water.
You're all just guessing. Face it, we don't know shit about Stickies, except that they're crazy mean and hard to kill.
Suddenly, Christy's face went deathly pale, and her sentient hair retracted, coiling tight to the sides and back of her head.
We've got company.
With a quick hand signal, Ryan split and spread his force. They all slipped into the haze. As they followed the footfalls away from the ruined ville, up a slight incline, the layer of smoke thinned a little. Not 30 feet away, they could see a raggedy man and woman moving low and fast along a shallow cleft in the earth. The man was carrying a small bundle in his arms. Ryan caught Jack's wrist as he prepared to throw a leaf-bladed knife.
No, they're not Stickies, and they're not armed.
At the sound of Ryan's voice, the refugees stopped running and huddled together in the ditch. As the companions ringed their position, the man put the bundle on the ground. It turned out to be a small, dirty child wrapped in rags. He and the woman took up a back-to-back defensive stance. From the scabbard at his waist, he drew a long, curving saber tinged with rust. The woman wielded a cudgel made of gnarled wood and spiked with sharpened prongs of rebar.
Come on, you Sticky bastards! We'll show you how chillin's done!
Take a closer look. We're not Stickies. We're not gonna hurt you.
Keep your distance! Husband, be careful. Don't let your guard down. They're not Stickies, but they could be cannies wanting to eat our little girl.
We're not cannies either. We're travelers from a long way off. Everybody sit and lower your weapons.
Ryan's friends showed themselves. He and they moved in a bit closer and sat. The man and woman relaxed a bit.
Are you from the ville?
Nothing left of it but smoke.
What happened?
We were overrun by Stickies. They attacked in waves, one after another. It wasn't long before we used up all the ammo for the few blasters we had between us. The Stickies kept on coming like there was no end to them. When they finally broke through the barricade, Me and Margie took the babe and ducked down a hidey hole I made for us. Stayed there until the stickies started tearing down the huts and burning them. Then there was so much smoke blowing around, we sneaked away without getting caught.
Did your ville have a name?
No, it wasn't much of a place. Sort of popped up along Baron Elijah's toll road so travelers could be safe after dark.
Baron Willie Elijah?
Of course. Where'd you say you come from?
Everybody's heard of Elijah. He led the other barons in the Muti War about 20 years back. Got them to combine their Sekhmen and Mercies to crush the Muti slave rebellion. They killed every mother's son they could get their hands on.
Old Elijah's always had a thing about keeping Mutis in their place. He's real picky about the purity of his bloodline, too. Doesn't want them Muti traits creeping in.
Is he still riding his own daughters?
Daughters? He's probably humping his granddaughter's brats by now. He's a nasty old goat, and he starts in on them before they've grown a full curl.
Yeah, he's gonna get what's coming to him, though.
How's that?
The stickies are all heading his way, like hungry locust bugs to Willieville. And in the front of them all is one Muti he sure should have chilled when he had the chance.
A Muti is leading them.
Oh, the biggest, ugliest bastard you ever saw. I recognized him right off. I seen him lots of times before, in a cage. Baron had him in his zoo for years, raised him up from a little bitty squirmer. Old Baron likes to gather things, and he doesn't like to let him go. Got this particular specimen from some Mercies after the Muti War. I reckon it's come payback time for old Elijah.
How far is Willieville from here?
That's about 21 miles.
Whoa, you're not thinking about going there, are you?
Might go for a look-see.
If we don't get there before the Stickies do, everyone in that ville is going to die, too.
We'll have to try to get the Eastern Barons organized for mutual defense, or nobody's going to stand a chance, including us.
That's a tall order. The Barons haven't worked together since the Muti War.
There's something else I think you should all know about it before you each decide what you're going to do.
What is that, dear fellow?
I've got a history with Willie Elijah that goes back to the war. I wasn't much older than Jack when I hired on with him as a Mercy. He and I parted on bad terms, and he might still remember and hold a grudge. What I'm saying is, because of that, he might not listen to anything I have to say. Worse, he might kill me and whoever's traveling with me.
You think this is worth the risk?
You saw what the Stickies did here. If we don't do something to stop them, they'll hunt down and erase our kind from Deathlands. Maybe from the whole world. I'm going on alone if I have to. Maybe that would be best anyway.
Count me in.
Me too.
Mildred, Jack, and Doc nodded. Satisfied, Ryan turned to the refugee couple.
Do you want to come with us?
To Willieville?
No, thank you, if it's all the same to you. That's the wrong direction for me and Margie. We've seen enough Stickies to last us. We'd rather take our chances in the bush.
The man dipped his fingers inside the slash pocket of his raggedy coat and took out a battered semi-auto. The rusted slide was locked back, the action open.
Got no more bullets for it.
The man dumped the magazine of the Brazilian knockoff of a Colt government model onto his palm.
Can you spare us 3 9mm slugs? Just in case we don't make it.
Ryan took some loose cartridges from his pocket and set them on the ground.
Don't touch them until we're out of sight. Let's go.
As Ryan flicked the sweat from his brow, he marveled at the way Doc could run. For 2 hours, they had been jogging on the highway's fractured surface, laboring under the weight of the extra ammo. For 2 hours, the academic had been at the front of the file, pounding out the pace in easy, loping strides. It wasn't fast, but it was gruelingly steady. Ryan held up his hand to shield his single eye from the glare of the noonday sun. Ahead, the Baron's toll road stretched into the flat distance. At the horizon, it vanished into a heat mirage, a shimmering lake of mercury. On the right side of the highway, the valley floor sloped to a barren expanse of silt plain, through which a sluggish brown river moved. The deeply eroded hills that framed the six-lane road were patched with clumps of stunted trees and spikegrass, and scrubby, knee-high colonies of orange and white, rad-mutated lichen. Ryan had decided to use the highway because it was the fastest and most direct route to Willieville. He wasn't concerned about the lack of defensive cover along the way, or that some part of the enemy force would be lying in wait along the road. Everything the Stickies had done so far indicated that they were moving in a single cohesive unit for some well-defined purpose.
The idea that one muti could lead and control that many stickies was as puzzling to Ryan as it was disturbing. Stickies usually had no external ears, which made it hard to communicate with them using speech. Orders had to be shouted at top volume and at the same time spoken very slowly and distinctly. It made complex operational control of large groups of stickies virtually impossible. The monsters in the back rows never got the message. And on top of that, stickies seemed to have unusually short attention spans. Something appeared in the middle of the Mercury Lake Mirage. A black form was headed their way. Ryan strained against the glare to keep the shape in focus. When the dark form cleared the mirage, its head flashed glacier white in the sun. Jack was returning from a long-range rec.
Doc, hold up. Jack's coming back. Let's take a breather.
The group slowed to a walk, then stopped to drop their loads and sit in the meager shade of the median strip's wall. Taking the opportunity to drink from their water bags, they let Jack come to them. Doc's Adam's apple bobbed mightily as he gulped down the tepid liquid.
Easy on that water, Doc, or you're just going to puke it all back up.
I bow to your expertise on such matters, dear doctor.
Ryan was glad to see that Mildred had recovered from the odd turn she had taken back at the burned bill. She had never acted like that before, and it worried him. Like Doc, she wasn't a native of this time and place, and didn't possess the psychic armor to protect her from the shocking violence, the unspeakable monstrosities that were part of day-to-day existence in Deathlands. When he had seen her come stumbling back from the heart of the Ville's Holocaust, he had feared for her sanity. He knew that Mildred's difficulties might well have been due to the after-effects of the Mattrans leap. That most recent nightmare had been particularly unpleasant for him. Though Ryan's lover had apparently recovered from her experience, he felt a distance between them that hadn't been there before. Perhaps it was his fault and not hers. His own jump dream had uncovered a side of his nature, a hunger that he had never recognized nor fully faced, and therefore had never shared with Christy. The hunger was for the blood and suffering of others, and it repelled and shamed him.
Found him. All stopped at the overpass. Mile and a half ahead around the bend.
Where are they stopped? What are they up to?
Didn't get close enough. No cover. Didn't want to risk being seen. Maybe lead them here. What they doing? Smell bad. Wind right in the face.
What about the leader? Did you see him?
All I saw was a pile of stickies blocking the road.
We gonna make a wide swing around them?
Not too wide. If a non-sticky is running the show, he's gotta be with them up ahead. We're gonna creep to within maybe 600 yards of their position, inside the chilling range for the SSG-70. If there's a clean shot on this leader of theirs, I'll take it. With any luck, maybe we can end this thing here and now.
Cut off the head, and the body will die.
But the body isn't going to die. There'll still be thousands of stickies on the loose around here.
Yeah, but without a leader, they'll break up into small hunting packs and spread out, the way they always do. The Baron Sekhmet can track them down and deal with them.
After they had all pulled their gear back on, Ryan led his friends off the highway. He took them into the sun because he wanted it at his back for the killing shot. They crossed a flat area of soft, moist, alluvial dirt. It was tough going, and they sank in up to their knees. The ground got harder the higher they climbed. When they reached the first patch of thorn trees, Ryan turned them parallel to the highway. They kept well below the ridgeline to avoid being silhouetted against the sky. Their route hopped from tree patch to tree patch, zigzagging around the bright fields of lichen. Though the frilly colonies looked harmless, looks were almost always deceiving in Deathlands. The fleshy fronds had no armor or poison sap to protect them. Indeed, they were very fragile and crumbled to bits at the slightest touch, which was, in fact, their defense. When the microscopic creatures broke apart, many became airborne. When inhaled by a passing animal, these individuals thrived inside the lungs. In a matter of days, they reproduced into a new colony there, which by sheer bulk suffocated the hapless victim. The companions reached a spot above the bend in the highway. Ryan paused behind a clump of thorn trees and scanned the road ahead. He could see the overpass, but even with mini binocs, he couldn't make out much detail because of the distortion of the heat waves rising off the roadway. Just a vague, whitish mound spread across six lanes.
Gaia, what's that?
Stickies making some kind of noise. All at once.
Let's get closer.
They trotted 100 feet below the ridgeline, working their way to a large patch of trees about 600 yards up from the overpass. The closer they got to the massive stickies, the more disturbing the sound became. They stopped at the cover of the thorn trees.
They're shouting the same thing over and over.
What's it mean?
His name! It's his name!
Ryan stared at Nogut in amazement. Whose name?
Their leader. They're calling for him to come forward. That's what they're doing.
How the hell do you know that?
When Nogut didn't answer, JB nudged Ryan with an elbow and passed over the binocs.
Have a look down there, Ryan.
The whitish mound they had seen in the distance was made of bodies, living bodies in constant motion. Stickies completely covered the overpass. They were heaped on top of the concrete bridge. They clung to the side railing, hanging off one another, spilling like a nubby carpet down over the roadway. The entire mass rippled and flexed as those on the tarmac climbed over their fellows, attempting to reach the top. Then, a lone figure appeared in the middle of the overpass. He clambered on top of the piles of prostrated bodies and stood on their necks and heads. He was Ryan's intended target, there was no doubt about that. And he was huge. Though the Muti leader towered over the Stickies, a better gauge of scale for Ryan was the M60 machine gun he held easily in one fist, like a handgun. The weapon had a strange paint job, blotches of hot pink, green, orange, and red, a sort of anti-camouflage, as if it were intended to draw notice and hostile fire. If the big man was saying anything to his troops, he was drowned out by their chanting. Waving his arms, he ran back and forth over the backs of their piled bodies.
He's in range. Chill him.
Ryan passed the binocs to Christie. As he unslung the Steyr SSG-70 bolt-action sniper rifle and uncapped the six-power scope, she lowered the binocs, a peculiar look on her face.
They're mating, Ryan. The Stickies are mating down there, making more Stickies.
How do you know that?
I've seen them doing it before.
Seen Stickies humping? When did you see them? Where?
In my jump dream.
Christy, you're making about as much sense as Mildred.
Dark Knight, Ryan, take the shot. Give me the gun and I will.
No, this one's mine. I'll do it.
Ryan chose a shooting position at the far end of the line of cover, where the trees were thin enough for him to crawl between their trunks without risking a snapped branch and sap poisoning, but where the leaves were thick enough to hide his scope and muzzle flashes from the enemy. Poking the barrel through the foliage, he quickly acquired the target in the telescope's view field. The SSG-70's scope was a little less powerful than the binocs, but its optics were of better quality. Through the heat mirage, he could see the big, bald Muti, his white skin blotched with patches of brown, or vice versa. Ryan couldn't tell if the patches were painted on or a permanent feature. The Muti wasn't just tall, but had huge muscles and no body fat. For his size, he was amazingly quick on his feet. As he darted from side to side on the overpass, Ryan couldn't hold the crosshairs on him for more than a couple of seconds. He realized that if he squeezed off a shot, chances were the big Muti would be a couple of feet one way or the other by the time the bullet reached the intended point of impact. It was a no-go. Watching the Muti general exhort his army, Ryan felt a surge of blind fury. It occurred to him that he didn't want to kill the bastard with a long-distance bullet anyway. He wanted to kill him up close, hand-to-hand. He wanted to cut off his massive bald head and wash his hands in the blood that jetted from the neck stump, to drink from it like a mountain spring. Ryan grit his teeth and shook off the hideous image. It wasn't his, he told himself. It was alien, intrusive, vile. He lowered the Steyr from his shoulder and crawled back to join the others.
It can't be done. The shot's clear, but he's moving around too much. I'll never hit him at this distance. And when I miss, all those Stickies down there are going to be chasing after us. They'll run us down, too. You can count on that.
You've got to chill the bastard! We may never get another chance!
No, it's too risky. We can't wait around here for a better opportunity. It's going to be hard enough to get around them and then stay ahead of them all the way to the Ville. We've got to go now while they're stopped. It's our only chance.
Mildred wanted to argue, but she didn't say another word. They moved in silence behind the line of mutated trees, following the curve of the hillside, past the Legion of Homicidal Monsters. Four hours later, when they were halfway to Willyville, Ryan signaled for a much-needed rest break. He led them up a ramp and onto a still-standing overpass. From that vantage point, they watched the highway behind them while they shared a few cold MREs, meals ready to eat, that JB had picked up in the redoubt's armory. After a few minutes, Mildred moved beside Ryan.
Ryan, that problem I mentioned back at the redoubt?
Uh-huh.
This seems as good a time as any to explain what I meant.
She waved for the others to come closer.
Everyone better hear this. It's important.
Go ahead.
Was there anything different about our last jump?
You mean the bad dreams?
Partly.
The Stickies using the Matran system.
Partly.
My dear Dr. Wyeth, is this some manner of guessing game? Because I'd love a turn at charades.
Shut up, Doc. Let me put it another way. Whenever we make a jump, our destination is usually fixed by the network's preset controls. Say we use a Matran's chamber in Idaho. We assume it always takes us to Louisiana. The Louisiana chamber will always take us back to Idaho if we use the LD button. To jump somewhere else, we have to find another redoubt and another gateway, and then we can only go forward and back between two predetermined points. We have no control over where the gateway sends us.
If that's supposed to be news, it isn't.
Hear me out. I believe the system wasn't meant to work that way. The designers were a lot of things, but they weren't stupid. Think about it. They wouldn't make a Matran's traveler in New York City jump to Brazil, then search the jungle for another redoubt in order to go to Boston. There has to be a way to program the individual gateways for multiple destinations.
So what's your point, Millie?
So, the Stickies have done just that. Don't ask me how, but they have. How else could they end up in the same chamber with us? We know they came from a different starting point.
Couldn't two gateways be auto-programmed to transfer matter to the same destination?
In all the jumps we've made, we've hardly ever gone from a new gateway to a place we've been before.
She's right.
You're saying the Stickies know something we don't about Matran's.
Or their leader does.
That's what it looks like to me.
What do you think, Doc? You've had more experience with Matran's units than any of us. You saw the Whitecoats actually running the system. Could she be right?
I fear I cannot say for certain. What the White Coat did to me in the time before Armageddon, I recall only vaguely and in scattered bits and pieces. I believe they transported me hither and yon just to test their ability to puzzle my atoms back together again. How and where they traveled themselves is beyond my ken. In truth, I was nothing more than their prisoner. However, I can tell you this. What the good Dr. Wyeth has postulated is grounded in the logic of Aristotle and the geometry of Pythagoras. To build a conveyance that could only take the most circuitous of routes makes no sense whatsoever. The shortest distance between two points is invariably a straight line.
If the Stickies can run the system and we can't, it's a fucking disaster.
It gets worse. I'm worried about the nightmares we had when we jumped this time. In my dream, I bowed down to a mutant who looked exactly like the guy back there on the highway. I recognized his name because I was yelling it in the dream.
Like I knew the Stickies were mating from my dream.
That's right. Look, we've all had nightmares during jumps before, but never, ever have we had the same kind of nightmares. The coincidence seems unlikely. There has to be a causal factor.
Have you formed any conclusions as to what it might be?
My understanding of the scientific principles of matter transfer is weak, but I know one thing for sure. The system has never had any trouble telling us apart before. I mean, I've never ended up with Christie's hair or Jack's red eyes or JB's memory. I think that's because we always start out together in the same chamber. If things happened the way I think they did, if reassembly instructions and source atoms arrived simultaneously from another gateway, there could be a serious problem.
You just lost me.
Okay, listen. A very long time ago, I saw a film. It was about a scientist who invented a kind of crude Matran's machine. Everything was working fine until a housefly slipped into the machine with him. When he transported, his body parts got confused with the flies. He ended up with a fly head, and the fly ended up with his. It's a tragic story that might apply to us.
Are you saying we could have traded something with the Stickies during the transfer?
I'm saying it's possible. If not something visible, then something on a molecular level.
We maybe turn sticky?
Before I'd let that happen, I'd eat the blaster.
Jack, JB, it doesn't work that way. We're fully reformed by the Mattran system. Whatever sticky traits we received would already be integrated into us. Pointy little teeth aren't going to pop out of our gums without warning. And whatever we received, if anything, it wasn't lethal or we'd already be chilled. Even if our physical structures weren't compromised, a mix-up in the chamber could explain our similar dreams, which, I remind you, appear to carry some element of truth. At the very least, we might have exchanged memories of real experiences with the Stickies.
Memories that aren't going away. I keep having flashbacks.
What can we do about it?
I don't know. Maybe I'm completely wrong and there's nothing to worry about. I sure hope so. But I think we should be aware of the possibility that some or all of us might have been changed by the jump.
Kaa wasn't his birth name. If he had been given one by his mother, he didn't know it. As he had no memories of the female who gave him life, he felt free to invent her. It had always pleased him to think that she had died trying to protect her baby on the day he was stolen by the Baron's mercies. Over the years, he had been called many things by the Norms: Blotch, Zit, Three Eyes. But this was the name he had chosen for himself. He hadn't taken it from some long-dead hero he admired. It had no literal or translational meaning, yet its symbolic power was undeniable. It was the one sound that all Deathland's diversely mutated humanoid creatures could make, the only sound they could all chant in unison. A fact he'd learned growing up as a specimen in Baron Willie Elijah's elaborate and extensive Mutie Zoo. Kaa was a name and a call to battle combined. And 5,000 Stickies opened their throats and howled for his pleasure. It was a hurricane of homage, of duty, of self-sacrifice. The piebald lord raised his arms for silence. He was naked, but for a knotted loincloth and jungle boots. He closed the wide-set yellow-brown eyes socketed above his heavy cheekbones, and with his fingertips pried open the single eye set in the center of his forehead. Blood-encrusted, lashless lids peeled back, exposing a moist white orb, like the newly laid egg of a small bird. It had no pupil, no iris, yet it could see. Seeing was the least of what that rad mutated organ could do. As he parted the protective flaps of skin, a tremor passed through the army of Stickies. When it was over, they were one with their leader, one with each other. What each individual soldier felt, they all felt. What each knew, they all knew. The Stickies accessed every neuron in their leader's mind, saw what he saw, and understood what he understood. Lord Kaa addressed his troops in an oration of image and sensation. He showed them that they weren't debased and despicable, not degenerate subhumans as their oppressors claimed. They were, in fact, demonstrably advanced beings, beautiful to behold, superior in strength and adaptation, in procreative ability. Therefore, they were a terrifying threat to the last dregs of the old genetic order, which sought through force of pre-dark arms to maintain its control over the much larger and rapidly expanding Mutie population. He showed them that their struggle against the injustice and domination of the Norms was glorious, and that their ultimate victory was assured. Deathlands was their world. They had been touched by it, changed by it in secret ways, and they, not the slave masters, were its true offspring and rightful rulers. Summoning all the power of his mind, Lord Kaa spilled forth a torrent of images that proved an even higher case that there was no division between Sticky and Scaly, Kenny and Zombie, Doomy and Swampy, save what the Norms had invented to keep them all apart. He told them that the Mutie peoples of Deathlands were, in fact, the scattered tribes of the Nukewind, destined one day to unite and rebuild the world in their image. With his glistening white eye, Kaa showed his army of maniacs what they couldn't otherwise see, their delicate and precious communal soul. And as he did this, his mutant pineal eye wept tears of watery blood that rolled down the sides of his nose and onto his lips. With careful fingertips, he closed the nerveless flaps of skin that hid his third eye. As he opened his Norm eyes, the rank, sweet-sour scent of the Sticky's mass coupling wafted up at him. Energized by the psychic networking, they rutted in a frenzy. Soon, the excess of their seed would flow down onto the boiling hot roadway, where it would erupt into pungent steam. Watching the Sticky's mate, Ka felt something stir between his thighs, his own need for sexual release. Though he could have used any or all of the mutants beneath him to achieve a climax, he did not. He was celibate, and had been all his life. Control of self was the most important thing he had learned in his long imprisonment. Control of self was the founding power, the basis of all else. His meticulously constructed conception of himself, of his future, didn't include premature fulfillment with either Mutie or Norm. He had turned down the advances of all the Baron's discarded daughter wives, as well as several of his current granddaughter wives. More than once, the jewels of Elijah's inbred harem had hiked their long skirts over their hips, and bending over, offered up their blonde mounds for a quick poke between the iron bars of his cage. Because Ka had bided his time, waited for his main chance, in the end, he had stolen something infinitely more valuable than a few moments of pleasure in the company of the Baron's half-wit concubines, something even more delightful than the planting of a three-eyed baby in the belly of every one of Elijah's pure Norm bitches. It had taken decades of subservience and humiliation, decades of pain, for Ka to gain the Baron's complete trust. And the pain wasn't merely his own. Ka had acted as Elijah's headsman, executing his fellow muties for crimes, real and imagined, against the royal personage. Once he had gained the man's confidence, he wasted no time using it to get what he'd always wanted. From the moment he'd understood what it was, he'd craved access to the tyrant's vast collection of pre-dark memorabilia, known as the Apocalypticon. He was the first and only mutie Willie Elijah had allowed to see his treasure, which he kept in a bank vault near his 25-story palace. On that initial visit to the Apocalypticon, Ka had realized that the Baron had no idea what he had collected, and no particular interest in finding out. Possessing it was enough for Elijah, until Ka had explained that if the Baron wanted to keep everything, it was vital to catalog it all. Otherwise, how would he know if anything had been stolen? In point of fact, the archive had already been plundered by Ka himself. When the Baron's back was turned, he had taken a fragment of text from a broken book he found on the floor, which he had rolled up and stuffed inside his shirt in case he never got a chance to return. It was a dangerous and impulsive act. If he had been caught stealing from his master, his death would have been agonizing and stretched out over many days, perhaps even weeks. He later came to believe that he had been fated to pick up that particular book. Of all the pieces of forgotten knowledge in the storeroom, he couldn't have chosen anything better to carry back to his cage than the Legends of Charlemagne. In secret, long before the Baron had agreed to let him be the librarian of the Apocalypticon, he had read, analyzed, and divined great truth from the ancient fragment. It had opened his mind to the idea of a creature of singular destiny, a creature who could unite all his people in a war of liberation. It showed him the possibilities of a return of honor, for final justice against cruel despots, for an empire that would span the width and breadth of Deathlands, an empire cleansed of norms. It had also taught him the concept of romantic love, which dovetailed nicely with his lifelong celibacy. Because there was only one mutie female meant for him, his true love, he was right to wait to mate. He named this unknown female Angelica, after a brave and beautiful princess in the fable of Rinaldo. It was for Angelica that he saved his seed. All that he had built so far, all that he would build in the future, he would share with her. And the two of them would found a dynasty that would rule for 1,000 years. He had carefully planned his escape from Willieville. He had left only when he was ready, after a full year of winnowing through the stacks of pre-dark material. When he went over the wall, Ka carried one treasure under his arm. Stamped in red ink across the front of the slim paperbound document was the warning, "Top Secret, for your eyes only." Below the security clearance was the title, "Operation Cerberus, Sys Design and Config." The document wasn't all he took with him. Inside his mind, he carried a framework of ancient stories memorized, of lessons learned, the bare scaffolding for his military campaign against the slave masters. Lord Kahn shook himself from his reverie. At his feet, a Sticky was birthing, its stomach muscles corded and rippling with contractions, its flaccid face flushed with strain. It was Rogero, one of Kahn's paladins. The piebald lord knelt down and thrust his hand into the Sticky's gaping wound. With his fingertips, he found the top of the unborn infant's head. Careful to avoid the teeth, he took a firm hold under the jaw and pulled the creature out into the world. For a moment, he dangled the blood-bathed infant Sticky by its umbilical cord as it slowly spun and snapped its jaws. Ka pressed the baby to one of the sucker-ringed purple teats on Rogero's hairless chest. It began to nurse at once. After a few hours of steady feeding, the baby Sticky would be too big to carry. Its own weight would uncouple it from the nipple. The little mutant would be able to run and hunt as soon as its feet touched earth, and at that moment, it would be as dangerous as a full-grown adult. The only difference being, it took smaller bites. By the time they reached Willyville, many hundreds more would have been birthed and nursed, fattened and readied for war. Ka's Sticky army would number closer to 6,000 than 5. Under his command, they would sweep over the Baron's defenses as if they were nothing, lay waste to the Great Ville, to its norms, scourge the earth and leave only cinders in their wake. The Baron's liberated Muti slaves would rise up and join the battle. It was only the beginning. Lord Ka planned to march over the eastern baronies, one after another, burning the estates to the ground, at each stop adding many thousands of Muti fighters to his ranks. By the time he was done, he would head an army the likes of which the world hadn't seen in many generations, an army that could conquer all of Deathlands and unite it under a single banner. Lester squinted through the telescopic sight of the toll booth's 90mm recoilless rifle and considered touching off a round or two, just to break the eerie silence. It had been a particularly boring day for the Baron Sekhman. Although it was nearly sunset, Lester and his crew had collected no tolls. For the 12 hours of their watch, the road had been free of traffic moving toward Willyville from the south. The booth in which they sat was a partially buried, wheelless, axleless, windowless, doorless semi-truck and trailer. Like a rusty red pimple, the cab of the junked truck stuck out of the base of the 25-foot-high berm wall, facing the highway south. The berm formed a defensive perimeter around the Willyville complex. Under the dirt barrier, fortifying it, were piles of trashed motor vehicles. The berm had been constructed by hand by Muti slaves at gunpoint. Slaves had likewise hacksawed off the back of the semi-tractor's cab and cut an opening in the front of the trailer, turning the buried rig into a tunnel, a pedestrian passage through the earthen wall. Wheeled carts using the Baron's Highway were directed to a different entrance, a narrow break in the berm that was blocked by the side of a semi-trailer that, because it still had wheels, could be rolled back and forth. The trailer gate opened onto a tight sec area, a kill zone really, where the human and animal-drawn vehicles could be searched while under heavy guard. As much as Lester wanted to, he didn't shoot the 90mm weapon. Ammo for it was not to be wasted on sport. Baron's orders. He set the bipod-mounted weapon back on the truck cab's roof and stretched his shoulders. He was standing halfway out of the top of the cab, in a crude hole hacked in the sheet steel. The day had been a hot one, and he was looking forward to the end of his shift, to a hard-earned tankard of tipple. Brewed in the kitchen of the Liberty Bell restaurant, to Willie Elijah's own specifications, the harsh, powerfully alcoholic barley wine was part of every sick man's daily wage. The brew's cloying kick disappeared after the first few sips, followed in short order by the onset of a most satisfying, warm and fuzzy stupefaction. If Lester stopped to think about it, most days in the booth were pretty dull. The Sekhman weren't allowed to shake down travelers for more than the Baron's toll, which was 10% of whatever they were carrying. Unofficial additional extortion by Sekhman tended to divert wayfarers from the toll route, which reduced the Baron's profits. Elijah, suspicious bastard that he was, kept watch on his toll takers with a pair of binocs from his penthouse suite in the Freedom City Motor Hotel and Casino. The only time Lester and his crew had any real fun was when travelers couldn't pay. Then the Sekhman could get a bit creative. They indentured the men as unpaid, unfed field slaves for up to a week, in exchange for the toll.
They put the women, if they weren't too old, and the girls to work on their knees, right there in the toll booth. If the sec man came across an especially interesting mutie among the migrants, say a baby with leathery vestigial wings and a spiky tail, they'd clobber the mother over the head and take it from her. The Baron had a long-standing bounty on unique specimens of the mutie races, which was how he populated his private zoo these days. Old Elijah could be generous, too. A sec man could spend a week drunk in the Willieville Gaudy on the reward. If the mutie parents put up too much of a fuss over losing their deformed brat, or if Lester's boys had had an otherwise slow day at the booth, they would chill both father and mother on the spot. The sec men would then drag the carcasses over to the Liberty Bell, where the cooks would chop them up, boil them down with spent grain from the brewery, and feed the stinking mess to the mutie field hands in slop buckets. The slaves, who were kept in hovels outside the berm, were always glad to get their grub. They never asked where or whom it came from. The Baron's slaves provided much-needed diversions for the 100 Sekmen who guarded Willieville. And not just in the gaudy. Sometimes the Sekmen staged mutie fights to the death over in the Independence Park amusement zone. They'd throw a couple of big mean ones into the mesh hopper of the spin and whip ride and let them tear each other's guts out, with high-stakes wagers on the outcome. Elijah also allowed them to bait the inmates of the mutie zoo. During certain hours and within certain limits, they weren't permitted to hurt the specimens physically. Yelling and spitting and occasionally pissing on them were okay, although the latter had to be done with speed and care, since the muties tended to piss back. Baron Elijah was touchy about keeping muties and Norm separated. Before he had hired Lester as a mercy in the mutie war, he had made him prove that he didn't have any bad blood in him. Lester was required to drag in his mother, father, sisters, and brothers, and their kids for a complete exam. The Baron was big on physical exams. He would sit there in his pre-dark lounger with a huge magnifying glass and a lit candle and look over the outside and as much of the inside of a prospect as he could get at without using a knife. He was an expert at finding a mutie sign. As far as Johnson Lester was concerned, it had been well worth his trouble to get on the Baron's payroll.
Lester, we got company. Stragglers at 10 o'clock.
Lester nodded to Highlander and scanned the road south. He saw a line of people jogging toward them, six by his count.
Trying to beat sundown.
Yeah, they're all carrying heavy packs and long blasters.
Highlander lowered his binocs. Under the thick brush of his auburn mustache, the tall sec man's mouth twisted into a grin. He elbowed Gil, the third man in the booth.
There's plenty of pickings there. This day might turn a profit for old Elijah after all.
Gil, when they're in range, give the signal cord to tug.
Their toll booth was connected by lengths of rope to the others spaced along the outside of the berm. The ropes were tied to aluminum cans with pebbles in them. A soft rattle would alert every sec position that someone approached the barrier. Lester picked up his battle-scarred KG-99 assault pistol and stepped from the cab. Behind him, Highlander and Gil spilled out of either side of the truck, spreading out to get the best firing angle and to offer the most difficult targets for return fire, if there was any.
Hey! Over there, you triple stoops!
When the six people headed toward him, Lester confirmed that they were heavily armed. He decided not to take any chances.
Do it now, Gil! Stop there! Stand in the circle painted on the road!
The travelers obeyed, stepping into a crude ring that was the aim point for the three other gun positions along the south side of the berm.
Keep your hands away from your blasters!
Lester moved closer, sighting on them down the barrel of the KG-99. The male traveler in front shifted as Lester approached, putting his body between the compact 9mm muzzle and his companions. He had a black patch over his left eye.
Well, nuke my nuts. If it ain't an old war buddy come back to pay us a visit.
Which one of them you know?
I know old One Eye there. Know him real good.
Not the One Eye. Caldor?
Yeah.
My. You're gonna keep us knee-deep in gaudy sluts for a week.
To hell with them scabbies.
Gil stepped up to the ring of death. He eyed Christie's long legs appreciatively.
I'd rather get to know this curvy redhead, inside and out, if you know what I mean.
Christie looked at him as if he were a bug, fit only for stomping. Gil aimed his M16 at her head.
Hey, Firetop. You ready to pay Willie Elijah's toll?
Christie's mane of red hair separated into tightly packed tendrils.
which coiled and writhed like individual serpents.
Damn, she's a mutie! She'd make a hell of a broodmare for the Baron Zoo!
Wrong, Rabbit Face.
Gil switched his aim to the one-eyed man.
What'd you call me?
Lester, we don't have time for this drooly shit. We've got important business with the Baron.
You're damn right you got business. The way I hear it, you forgot to tell Elijah goodbye when you went over the wall all those years ago. And he was set to give you a parade and medals for the rebel mutants you chilled. Willie Elijah don't ever forget a scornful hurt like that.
Holding his weapon steady, Lester approached the one-eyed man.
Dump your blasters and knives down on the road.
We keep our weapons. There's an army of stickies coming up the road behind us. Don't know how far back they are.
The three Sekmen looked down the highway south. There was nothing to see except the sunset burnishing the long, straight stretch of concrete in shades of purple and orange.
We gotta tell the Baron.
Willie Elijah'll be eaten about now. You know he doesn't like to be bothered at his meal.
If you don't get us up to see him pretty damn quick, more stickies than you ever saw are going to be joining him for dessert.
One Eye is chock full of shit. Stickies don't have no army.
They do now, my arrogant young friend.
How about I kick your scrawny ass up and down the road? I could use the exercise.
Gil crossed into the painted ring. There was something about the old man that Lester didn't like. Sure, he looked crusty and slow, but for an instant, his eyes seemed to be measuring the distance between himself and Gil. It occurred to Lester that the crusty bit might be an act, that he might be playing possum in order to sucker the Sekman in close.
Step back, Gil! Step back now!
Lester's combat instinct was correct, even if it was a bit hazy as to the details. Gil was within seconds of having his heart parted by a swordstick's double-edged blade.
Dump the blasters now or get blown to hell!
The one-eyed warrior glanced over Lester's shoulder, searching the front of the berm. Lester could see him take in the permanent gun emplacements, one by one. No way could he miss the Sekman standing with guns braced and ready to send a withering rain of fire into the painted circle. No one would make it more than a dozen feet outside the ring before being chopped down. With a pained expression that pleased Johnson Lester no end, Ryan faced his companions and nodded. They carefully lowered their packs and collection of weapons to the ground. Lester gestured with his weapon as other men came out and took up everything the traveler set down.
Okay, hands up, through the hole. One Eye, you know the way. Up to it.
Hands in the air, Ryan let himself be shoved through the trailer tunnel in the berm. He felt naked and vulnerable without his guns. As much as he hated being disarmed, he hated putting his friends in that position even more. Yet, giving up their guns was a necessary evil, a calculated risk they had to take. It was the only way for them to get through the gates of Willieville quickly and alive. Their sole task was to convince Willie Elijah that the Stickies were coming. If they succeeded in making the Baron believe he was in jeopardy, they would get their weapons back and have their chance to fight and perhaps to survive. If they didn't manage to convince him, whether they got their guns back or not, it wouldn't make any difference in the long run. As Ryan and his friend stepped out the rear doors of the trailer, six more armed Sekmen swung in behind them. After a rough pat-down for hidden weapons, they were escorted across an open field of yellow dirt and dried-up grass. Ryan was amused to see that the Sekmen had left Doc his walking stick. About a half mile away, above a high hurricane fence, loomed the post-apocalypse metropolis of Willieville. It was pretty much as Ryan remembered it. Dominating the skyline was the tall pre-dark building that served as the Baron's headquarters and barracks for his Sekmen. Even in the soft and somewhat flattering rays of sunset, it looked like the last rotten tooth in a dead man's jaw. The side that faced them was checked from top to bottom with windows, many of them black and broken. Orange lights flickered in the rooms with intact glass. As they passed through the rolling gate in the hurricane fence, Ryan could see the rest of the complex. The landscaping of the grounds, which had never been looked after, had deteriorated to bare dirt and mummified plant beds. The curving concrete or asphalt driveways, paths, and parking areas were split and broken by bristling tufts of spikegrass. Clustered around the base of the Baron's HQ were a few low buildings. With their peeling paint and crumbling masonry, all of the structures looked scabrous. On the other side of the broad scar of real dirt that in happier times had been an 18-hole golf course, Ryan could make out the top of a motionless Ferris wheel and the stark white skeleton that supported the roller coaster's tracks. The Baron's infamous Mutie Zoo was back there too, out of sight. A slight shift in the wind brought the sickly sweet smell of Willie Elijah's brewery rushing over them. Ryan recalled that the beer was made in the one-story building off to the right of the golf course. He also remembered the way the malty, scorched stink permeated the entire ville in the dog days of summer. Farther to the right was the Gaudy, which had once been a fuel and repair station for gas and diesel-powered motor vehicles. Beyond the decrepit amusement park, on the other side of the berm, were the ville's slave quarters. The Baron liked to keep his muties outside the walls at night. A small number of muties who handled menial tasks inside the berm were hobbled by chains and shackles on their ankles. On the other side of the slave hovels, which the muties shared with the Baron's livestock, were cultivated fields. Elijah maintained a kind of pecking order of deformity among his field workers. The least obviously mutated served as overseers to the more grossly radiation-altered ones. Because Ryan hadn't witnessed the full glory of late 20th century humankind, he had no yardstick by which to judge the merit of this place. Willieville and other decayed settlements like it were all that remained of human civilization. And the Baron, grievously flawed leader though he was, had created a secure border for his subjects. Willieville's defenses were so imposing, the town had never been successfully stormed and sacked, either by muti bandits or by other Baron's mercies. If there was to be a rebirth of human culture in Deathlands, it would have to begin someplace like this, where there was relative safety, agriculture, and primitive industry. Their armed escort steered them toward the massive steel and concrete slab awning that protected the main building's front entrance and U-shaped driveway. Across the face of the structure were huge, faded, red, white, and blue script letters that read Freedom City Motor Hotel and Casino. They passed under the awning and through cracked plate glass doors that were defended by a half dozen armed guards. The lobby of the hotel was a bleak expanse of glue-stained concrete subfloor, which had been stripped of all furniture, rugs, and other decoration. The lobby was barren except for off-duty sec men who eyed them contemptuously as they were herded past. There were no civilian residents of Willieville in evidence. Johnson Lester led the way to the ground floor's twin elevators and pointed at the elevator car visible between parted doors on the left. The doors on the right were open as well, but there was no car to be seen. And there were no cables visible either. He waved them into the car.
All of you get down on your knees. Face the rear wall with your hands behind your backs. Don't move until I tell you to.
After Ryan and the others obeyed, a few sec men pushed in behind them. When all were aboard, Lester leaned toward a funnel connected to a hollow tube set in the lobby wall.
23! 23!
The car started to creep upward.
How in the name of hell are they running this thing?
A few dozen slaves in the basement. Elijah keeps them chained to this gear contraption that winds up the cables as they push it around and around a big post. They push it the other way to let the car down.
There's a lot of weight in this thing to be lifting that way.
It's safe enough going up. Going down is the problem. Did you see the other shaft in the lobby? The empty one? That car got away from the slave crew years ago. They tried to stop it from crashing in the bottom of the shaft, but it was impossible. They all got battered to death by the machinery.
It took 10 minutes for them to get from the lobby to the 24th floor. As soon as they stepped out of the car, it was clear where all the lobby furnishings had gone. The hallway was jammed with couches and armchairs. They sat along the opposing walls in unbroken lines, arm crushed against arm, like the showroom of a shabby discount furniture warehouse. And above them, the walls were covered with large, uninspired oil paintings of crashing surf on a rocky shore, quaint farms with red barns and snowdrifts, and storm-besieged sailing ships. The couches and chairs were filled to overflowing with the wives and children of the important men of the town, the Baron's accountants, his sec chiefs, his skilled craftsmen, emissaries to other barons, licensed exporters of agricultural products and tipple. Well-dressed and clean, the children sat quietly beside their mothers or in their laps. Each child held a small bag of confetti on his or her knees. When the Baron and his wives made their regal exit from the dining room along this corridor, they would be showered with bright bits of paper. Lester prodded his charges toward a doorway at the end of the hall. Four sec men stood guard over the entrance, and as Lester approached, they blocked it with their bodies and rifles.
I need to see the Baron.
He's already started eating. He doesn't want to see you while he's stuffing himself. You might break his rhythm or even put him off his feed. Come back later after he's had his snooze and a hump.
This is important. It can't wait that long.
Oh, yes, it can. It can wait as long as I say.
Lester seized Ryan by the arm, and holding the muzzle of the KG-99 hard against his temple, pulled him close.
This here's a deserter from the Muti War the Baron's been after for years. Go on in there and tell him I brought him a special dish. Tell him it's called One-Eye Cawdor on a Plate.
Well, shit. All right, but it's your funeral.
With guns pointed at their heads, Ryan and the others were pushed into the suite that the Baron had converted into a cavernous dining hall. The place was lit by smelly torches and stanchions. Though there were many people in the smoky room, Elijah and his family were the only ones eating. The rest were either servants, who moved back and forth with food trays and beverage tankards, or the Baron's male toadies, who filled rows of straight-backed chairs like an audience gathered for an evening of chamber music. Chewing pensively, Baron Willie Elijah sat in a black lounger behind a heavily laden table on a raised dais. The platform was so high, he risked bumping his head on the ceiling when he stood. Sitting at tables below him on the floor level, and also chewing, were his three wives and their three baby daughters. Lester bent in a low, scraping bow to his master, then half-straightened.
Baron, I've captured the deserter, Ryan Cawdor.
So I see.
Elijah looked up from his dinner to survey first Ryan, then his friends. On the dais beside Elijah's feet was a great brimming jar of tipple. He drew the long-handled dipper from the beer bucket and sluiced a half pint through his cheeks to clear his palate. The meal set out before him was plain fare and plenty of it. Huge clods of pan-roasted flesh, a steaming pile of potatoes cooked in their jackets, a pre-dark 1 gallon plastic bucket full of brown gravy, stacked loaves of crusty flatbread. The Baron ate it all with his bare hands. While they awaited his further word, Elijah picked up a hot potato and squeezed it until the skin split, then sucked the white starch out through the crack.
Ah!
He followed it with a swallow of gravy right from the bucket, then a gulp of beer and quickly back to the roasted clods and bread.
I caught him trying to sneak through the toll booth with these other stoops. I can't tell about the others, but for sure two of his running buddies got bad blood. The red-eyed boy and the red-haired bitch. Looks like the butcher of Coopville's gone muty lover on us, Baron.
Lester's master failed to rise to the bait.
Well, Carter, it's been a good long time since you and me last faced off. What do you think of the way my little gal's filled out?
The Baron's wives blinked their pale, straight, corn-silk eyelashes at Ryan. They looked so much alike they could have been born triplets. Their round faces bore the same blank expression, and their straight, fine blonde hair was parted in the middle and fell to the middle of their backs. They appeared to be in their early to middle teens and were clad in long dresses with extremely low, tight necklines that with every breath threatened to send plump breasts popping out of their tense confinement. The wives bounced baby girls on their laps. Though he wanted to skip the small talk and rush into the important subject at hand, Ryan couldn't risk offending Elijah with the very first words out of his mouth.
They look even younger than the last time I saw them. Which one's Poony? Which one's Toony?
You're a whole generation off, Carter. You're looking at Poony 2, Toony 2, and Rooney 2.
Ah, your granddaughters. How are your mothers doing, girls?
There was no response from the royal harem. Ryan guessed that Elijah's daughters were already long dead, killed by the Baron just as their mother, his first wife, had been, as soon as the new crop of females came ripe for harvest. Time hadn't been kind to Willie Elijah. The Baron's hair, his pride and joy, which had once been corn-silk blonde like his granddaughter's, was now stiff and white and unmanageable. He tied it in a loose bun at the back of his head. He had on a quilted plum velvet smoking jacket, which leaked stuffing from holes in the shoulders and elbows. He wore no shirt under the smoking jacket. The coarse white bristle of his chest hair spilled over his food-stained lapels. Loosely draped around his neck was a blue silk scarf with black tassels on the ends. His trousers were baggy, wine-colored corduroy, and his shoes were a pair of pre-dark sandals known as Birkenstocks. Because he wore no socks, Ryan could see his great, horny, yellow toenails. Even from across the room, the Baron smelled like an unhosed bear pit. Ryan remembered him as being a taller, more imposing figure. Certainly the flesh of his face didn't used to hang down below the line of his jaw, and his cheeks had never been scruffy with white stubble like that. Even his eyes looked ancient. They were bloodshot, and the whites had a yellowish tinge to them. From too much of his own brew, no doubt.
But Ryan knew it would be a mistake to underestimate Elijah, even in his present condition. Though the man had been scourged by time, he was still dangerous, cruelly perverse, and unpredictable. And they had placed their fates in his hands.
So, Carter, did you come back to try and make amends after all these years? Maybe beg me for forgiveness?
The audience of Toadies nodded its unanimous approval. They liked a good and proper show of begging, especially when it was doomed to be fruitless.
We came to warn you. There's 5,000 stickies on your toll road. They're coming north to level this place. They already wiped out your little way stop 20 miles south. Burned it to the ground.
That's a good one, Carter.
Elijah picked up a potato and threw it at Ryan's head, but missed when his intended target easily ducked the warm missile.
Baron, I think One Eye was sure he could sneak past Willyville without anybody recognizing him.
Baron, that's bullshit. I wasn't trying to sneak by your ville. Fireblasted, I wasn't even wearing a disguise. With a face like mine, I'd have to wear a hood and a mask to keep from being noticed. I came here for one purpose, and that was to warn you. And I did it knowing there was still a price on my head. Ask yourself, why would I risk my life to sell you some nuke shit made-up story about stickies when I could have easily taken a 10-mile detour and avoided Willyville altogether? You know I'm no stoop. What possibly could be in this for me except maybe an early death?
The Baron sipped from his tankard as he considered the question.
We talked to the only survivors from the Burnedville of yours. They told us a mutiny was leading the stickies up the toll road. We outflanked them on the highway and got close enough to see the bastard for ourselves. The survivor said you know him. Said that you used to keep him in your zoo. His name's Ka.
I don't ever give my mutie pets formal names, Carter. They ain't worth the trouble. You should remember that from the old days.
As if losing interest in the conversation, the Baron started picking through the mound of meat in front of him.
We saw this mutie leader with our own eyes about 6 hours ago. He's close to 7 feet tall and powerfully built. He had unusual coloring on his skin. Brown and white patches all over.
Elijah squashed the chunk of cooked flesh in his fist, squirting warm grease on his jacket. Ryan had touched a raw nerve.
You lie. You lie trying to save your cowardly deserting to hide, and it isn't going to work. Nobody I hired walks out on me and lives. Nobody.
If I'm lying to you, Baron, you'll know it soon enough. The Sticky Army couldn't be more than a few hours behind us. They'll be here before daybreak. Until then, what's it going to hurt to get your Sekhmen ready for the attack? What's it going to hurt to send out a warning to the other barons around here? Maybe they'll even give you some reinforcements, which you'll need. But whatever you do, you've got to start now, before the Stickies lay siege to Willyville. Me and my friends will fight alongside you.
Toony Two looked up.
He could be a spy, Papa Daddy!
Rooney Two nodded eagerly.
Yeah, a spy from Byramville, working for Blackheart Hutton.
See that? I don't grow no stoop girls, One Eye. What do you say? Did you sell me out to that thieving, rat-tated bastard who runs Byramville? Is it a trick to get Blackheart Sekhmen inside my walls so he can take my treasure and diddle my pure norm gals?
I'm no spy. Just think about what I'm saying for a minute. Protecting yourself from the other barons isn't a problem. If you're worried about somebody pulling a trick on you, don't let any of their Sekhmen inside the walls. But put every one of your men on triple red tonight. You've got nothing to lose.
Elijah pondered the matter in silence for a moment or two, then rose to his feet.
I don't see no downside to me here. Anybody see a downside?
None of the toadies dared say a word. They just looked at each other and shrugged.
I'm gonna do what you say, Carter. But don't think it's going to buy you any mercy from me, even if 10,000 stickies show up at my gates. You're mine, and you're going to die the way I see fit. I got to think a while on how I want to do it, though. I've been waiting so long for this, it's got to be something extra special. Something extra painful.
Do whatever you want with me, but let my friends go. They don't owe you anything. They came here to help me save your skin.
Take One Eye, the old bastard, the one with the glasses, and stick him in the cooler overnight. For now, the Red Eye boy goes to the zoo.
He's not a mutie.
Shut it, Carter.
And the women?
Before Elijah answered, one of the toadies stood and raised his hand for permission to speak. Even though he'd lost 90% of his hair and put on 70 pounds around his middle, Ryan recognized Lee Strutz, the whoremaster, from the old days.
Baron, if you haven't already made up your mind about the Black One, I'd like to stake a claim on her. She's got a sturdy look I like. With a little training from me and my boys, she'd take it any way you want to put it to her. As long as you want. Make a nice addition to the gaudy stable.
Mildred went rigid beside Ryan. The expression on her face mingled fury and horror. The physician had been willing to give up her life if necessary to save these norms from the sticky hordes. She certainly hadn't figured on being turned out as a gaudy slut.
No, Strutz, you got enough warm bodies down there. She goes to the cooler with the men, and when they die, she dies too.
Ryan watched Mildred relax.
Lester, get him out of my sight! Oh, but the red hair, she stays here with me. And somebody bring me my magnifier glass. It's beauty exam time, boys!
Ryan leaned close to Christy.
I'm sorry. We'll get out of this mess somehow. Hang in there.
You too, lover.
Under the bravery and defiance that flashed in her green eyes, there was fear. Before Ryan could say more, the Sekhmen separated him from Christy with the muzzles of their guns, then roughly shoved him, Mildred, Jack, JB, and Doc toward the exit.
Wait a minute! What's that stick the old one's carrying?
Nothing, Baron. He's a crippy. Needs it to walk. Otherwise, he'd have to be carried.
Let me see it.
Lester snatched the ebony cane away from Doc and passed it up to Elijah. The Baron examined the silver handle, found the release catch, and unsheathed the rapier.
What's this? You let a weapon get past your search? You let him bring a sword in here?
Baron,
Elijah resheathed the blade and threw the stick back at the sick man.
Put it in my quarters with the rest of their gear. You're going to pay for that mistake, Lester. Tomorrow, you're going to take a turn on the wheel.
Lester's jaw went slack. His face suddenly paled. He didn't protest the sentence. Those who protested did two turns. At this point, Elijah's servant rushed up with the magnifier. Set in a brass frame and handle, it had a convex lens 6 inches across. With a sweep of his arm, the Baron sent the food platters on the table before him to the floor. Having cleared his exam table, he waved a hand at Christy.
Bring her up here to me. Strip her down and move the candles closer. I need plenty of light for this kind of work.